on Pleasure's Oral. Lawrence and I had sampled only a small part of Venice when Monica arrived. Disembarking at the Piazza San Marco, we crossed it, noting the Duomo's landmark rotunda, the rows of apostles draped in scaffold and net. We checked into our hotel, the Panada, at 5 o'clock and had dinner at 10, a very light supper at the Pescatore Conte. The next morning, dawn awakened us, weaseling its way in through the casements, creeping down draperies, columning them in substance. The scent of baking bread followed the light, then sound, the clatter of pots and pans of children's voices rising from the street below. When Monica disembarked, we were seated at a sidewalk cafe on the perimeter of the Piazza San Marco. Across the wide, noon-bright circle of the piazza, she progressed, a scintillating clove-brown figure, an exotic and imperious Cleopatra clad in saffron, and a saffron blouse and billowing peasant skirt, preceded by a porter carting her enormous black suitcase and a few smaller bags. Her head was uncovered, scarved only in the straight, black fall of her hair. She seemed made for the heat. Her Italian movie star carriage had the usual grand and eye-stopping effect. Pigeons scattered, heads turned. Men's hands reached involuntarily out toward her as she passed, thumbs and forefingers kissing in empty pinches that would never be consummated. At that moment, I realized that I loved Monica in the same way that I loved my Barbie dolls as a child, with a passionate attachment one feels toward an ideal shimmering on the distant, never-to-be-attained horizon. Men also had this feeling for her. Lawrence and I pushed back our chairs, threw our napkins down next to our plates, and advanced toward her with the well-choreographed precision of two chorus line extras supporting the principal dancer. She rewarded us with a white flash of smile. "Ciao," she sang out to us. "When did you get here?" "Last night," we answered in unison. "Don't you love it?" Monica crooned, echoing the plump pigeons that cooed, pecked, and preened around our ankles and feet, their feathered bodies pressing carelessly up against us. "More so now because you're here," we responded. "Well, I have to get rid of this luggage," she confided with well-practiced urgency. "Then I'll show you my Venice." I have always felt very small next to Monica, small and childlike, like a pawn. My adoration only increases when I see the impact she has on everyone else. On her ample bosom, Lawrence's head had found a place to come, metaphorically to rest. At least I hoped it was metaphorical. I watched the two walk arm in arm ahead of me while I dawdled on bridges and the chipped, gap-toothed buildings leaned toward us, leering like doddering courtiers drunk with the sunlight. "Where did you eat last night?" Monica asked as we walked past a series of portside cafes on the Canale della Guideca. "At the Pescatore Conti," Lawrence replied. "Hmm," she said thoughtfully, as if trying it out in her mind. "I've never eaten there." She paused for a moment, considering this. "Well, tonight," she said with a long, slow smile, "we will dine at the Bai Barbacani. It's better even than that one au Pied de Cochon in Paris, remember? You'll love it. I'll introduce you to Aldo, the owner. I wonder if he'll remember me." There was no doubt in my mind about this. We expected other friends to join us in the afternoon, but they arrived exhausted. Dinner for them was out of the question. Night had pitched its black tent over the city. Monica in her sunflower yellow dress gleamed like a beacon beneath the lanterns that lined the narrow alleyways near the canal. On the marled stone walls that rose from the shadows on the opposite bank, small windows opened, like the tiny doors in an advent calendar, torchlit, adventures seeming to smolder within their confines. The entrance to the Bai Barbacani was behind one of these windows. We crossed a narrow bridge to Calle del Paradiso, on the other side of the canal. At the portals of the Bai Barbacani, we were greeted by a slender, tuxedo waiter who escorted us into the cave-like interior to a round, white-cloth table where the candlelight danced sylph-like over crystal, china, and silver. Light flooded over Monica's shoulders, pooling gracefully at the juncture of her breasts. Her eyelashes cast shadows on the rise of her cheeks. Lawrence's hair glinted fiery. Our waiter seemed adequate, but Monica was still restless, her eyes on a tall, broad-shouldered man, impeccably dressed in a double-breasted blue jacket cut to enhance a narrow waist. He was making his way across the room, stopping at each of the tables and chatting with guests. His progress was arrested at the table next to ours, for he seemed to have found among these diners several dear friends. "Aldo?" I asked. "No," said Monica. "Aldo's not here," she added with just a soupçon of petulance. I noticed that the slightest of pouts had settled upon her carnation red lips. The restaurant seemed to have changed, to have been rearranged. Gone were the dusty bottles of homemade fragolino that Monica had raved about. The broad-shouldered man was laughing, leaning into the table right next to us, ignoring our table completely. He summoned a waiter who disappeared into the back of the restaurant and returned with what must have been a very special bottle of wine. It was uncorked with great ritual. The diner who sampled it nodded his head furiously. The broad-shouldered man squeezed his arm and moved on to us. His dark hair was thin and cut very short. He had eagle-like features. "Welcome to the Bai Barbacani," he said in musically accented English. "Where's Aldo?" Monica demanded in response. "He is gone," said our host. Monica let him know that Aldo was missed. "I was here before Aldo," the man replied simply. "I went away, and now I am back. Aldo is gone." He said this with the finality of a man who's used to fitting his confreres with shoes of cement. "I don't believe you," Monica whispered tauntingly. "I think you have Aldo locked up in the basement." "So," the man said, looking down at Monica, noticing appreciatively the way the darkness gathered at the top of her breasts like a pendant of jet and sliding between them disappeared into the soft yellow fabric of her bodice. He looked up at us and smiled. Monica told the man that Aldo had promised her certain secret recipes when she returned, and she wasn't pleased to find him no longer there. Our new host was given to understand that she liked him less. He asked her, "You don't like me as much?" Monica shrugged and smiled. "I miss Aldo," she said. It was a challenge, a gauntlet thrown down. Then it began, the wooing. Perhaps it was the candlelight that bathed everything in a kind of fairy tale beauty. Perhaps it was the desire to best the chivalrous Aldo. Or maybe it was the Circean net that Monica carried for occasions like this one. Whatever the cause, though the waiter returned and was very solicitous, the man could not seem to stay away from our table. Come back to the kitchen with me. I can show you how to stir the risotto," he said archly. We had visions of Monica being abducted into the back, into the restaurant's nether regions, into the basement where Aldo was most certainly buried. Monica laughed. "Maybe," she said, "maybe later." For an appetizer, Monica ordered a bowl full of mussels, and our host nearly swallowed his tongue. Piled high on their perfect white china bowl, each glistening shell held the tiny mollusk that is compared to that most delicate part of a woman's anatomy. Pry open the shell, shut tight as a virgin's thighs, and you feast on the sweet mound of flesh in its own fragrant liquor. Dress them with wine, or eat them undressed. Either way, to consume them is heaven. Paolo, by this time we knew his name, leaned over Monica's shoulder and asked, not so innocently, if she'd like him to put a little lemon on them. Monica said yes, so he called over the waiter, who arrived with the proper tools, a silver plate holding a gauze-wrapped half-lemon and a small silver spoon. Paolo expertly disrobed the lemon and took firm hold of the spoon. He very aggressively screwed his small spoon into the lemon, dribbling its juices all over Monica's muscles. Monica watched him. He continued to screw away, eyes upon hers, really building up a sweat in the process. It seemed to go on forever. I was amazed. I'm sure none of us thought that there could be that much juice in a single lemon. But Paolo was determined to lemon up the muscles to Monica's satisfaction or knock himself out in trying. It was pathetic. Monica, I wanted to plead, make him stop. As if reading our minds, Monica finally said, "That's enough." "Thank you," she purred demurely. Imaginary handkerchiefs went to three foreheads, Lawrence's, Paolo's, and mine. I had ordered sweet and sour sardines for an appetizer. I don't want to speculate upon their metaphorical value. Lawrence had ordered mussels as well, but all he got were a few cursory twists of lemon from the waiter. Monica consumed her mussels with incredible gusto and even offered a few to me, although she knows I'm allergic to shellfish. It's an allergy I developed recently and one that I never managed to recollect without a puritanical pang. The appetizers had nearly exhausted us. I wasn't sure we were ready to deal with our entrees. To calm my nerves, I ordered risotto, a sweet, pearly mixture, perfectly flavored, designed to comfort the taker. Lawrence had scampi, meaty pink prawns that he separated from their wafer-thin jackets of exoskeleton with fingers perfumed in lemon water. Monica ordered gnocchi, a regional favorite. Satiny black pillows colored with cuttlefish ink and bathed in a fragrant salmon red sauce. Before us, the simple potato dumplings lay, transformed into something incredibly sexy. Round two, I thought. Victoria's Secret. Frederick's of Hollywood. Paolo appeared again along with the entrees. "This is the perfect choice for you," he said to Monica, his hand braceleted to the wrist, gesturing toward her plate. "I love those colors," giggled Monica. "Come to the kitchen with me," Paolo challenged with a canine grin. "I will show you how it is done." Monica laughed. "I'll bet," she said, and bit into one of the little black pillows. Her sharp teeth cut a tiny half moon out of one side. I'd swear Paolo was salivating. "Do you know," he asked, warming to the subject of food as he watched Monica eat, "do you know how I like to eat spaghetti?"
"No, how?" asked Monica.
"I float a wooden bowl of spaghetti in my swimming pool." His large hands placed an imaginary bowl upon the cobalt blue water shimmering in front of him. "Then I float up to it." We could now picture him in swim trunks, approaching the spaghetti that bobbed in its big wooden bowl on the water's flickering surface. "Then I suck the spaghetti slowly out of the bowl," he said, looking down at Monica. He was grinning from ear to ear.
"Oh, that sounds wonderful," Monica responded, placing her napkin beside her plate and gazing up at his dark brown eyes.
"You could try it," he said, raising an eyebrow.
"Do you know what my favorite food is?" Monica countered. "It's mascarpone cheese. Do you know how to make mascarpone?"
"Yes," said Paolo. "This cheese takes a long time."
"It does," agreed Monica. "I make fabulous mascarpone. I can teach you to make it my way."
"I would love to make mascarpone with you," said Paolo formally. I half expected him to salute.
"La vie est belle,"
Monica laughed. "Toujours l'amour," Paolo chimed back. The cliches began flying back and forth like shuttlecocks. Paolo would not leave our table. He catered to us to the point of neglect of the rest of his clientele. Diners order desserts and after-dinner drinks. He ignored them. Regulars paid bills and left the restaurant. He ignored them. We struggled through apple strudels and torts and polished things off with homemade fragolino, a strawberry liqueur more fragrant, Monica declared, than Aldo's. "This is my fragolino," Paolo said with great pride. It was like perfume, really, a dark, beautiful perfume. We chuckled and whispered that he probably had Aldo locked up in the basement making the stuff. Hours had passed.
Candles had burned down to mere stumps. All of the other diners were gone. "Will you come again tomorrow night?" Paolo asked Monica, leaning over her chair, his mouth close to her ear.
"No," Monica said, turning her face to his, her nose nearly touching the sharp beak that was his. "No, but I'm here every year."
"Well," he said, as she rose from the table, "you must come again next year." He took Monica's arm and escorted her gallantly back to the restaurant's threshold. "I will give you the secret then, to the Fragolino," Paolo said solemnly, exchanging cards with Monica, promising the recipe next year if she came, just as Aldo once had. Lawrence and I knew better, of course. We'd seen this happen before. We knew that the meal most longed for is the meal not yet eaten. We knew that Paolo's appetite had been aroused. And we knew for certain that sometime, long before the promise next year, there'd be a knock on Monica's door. And there he would be, the man with a hunger for mascarpone.